Welcome to Paradigm Shifters. Oh, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to talk about the brain today. How many of you are concerned about your brain and how to empower it? My guest is a popular guest on Paradigm Shifters, Jim Emke, who's a clinical nutritionist, but he's also known as a health detective. Jim, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Veronica. I'm happy to be back. Health detective. I like that, though.
You know? I do, too. I think it's perfect. Because actually, isn't it tricky sometimes to know where people are deficient or what's going on that is, for example, dropping the function of someone's brain? That's pretty tricky, isn't it?
It is. And a lot of practitioners, particularly alternative practitioners, but I'm sure medical practitioners can appreciate this, too, see a lot of challenging cases, mysterious cases that you really need to investigate and dig deep to get the appropriate information to help you crack the case, so to speak.
And actually, when you talk about the brain, and I agree with what you just said, but talking about the brain, aren't we discovering a whole lot more about how to re-nurture it, or the brain plasticity, which is, I guess, what's the name? Bruce Lipton came up with that phrase, or someone did anyway, that we used to think the brain was that, and that's the way it stuck. And he's saying, no, there's a whole lot that can be changed in the brain now. So you're kind of on the cutting edge nutritionally with some of that, aren't you?
Yes, I hope to be, and certainly do my best to stay current with it in this field and in the entire field of health. It's a full-time job just to stay current with all the information that's out there.
I know.
So I'm glad I've been practicing for 42 years full-time. Otherwise, I don't know. It would be awful hard to keep track of everything that's going on. The information rate used to double like every 4 years. I don't know what it is now, but it's rapid.
Yeah, it's really kind of trebling and quadrupling. It's quantum stuff, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess that's one way to put it.
But I want to ask you, this is a funny question, and then I'll go back to what you wanted to talk about. But do you think that we are evolving as a species and that's a part of what's so available? Or do you think it's just that we're investigating better into the workings of the brain?
Well, I would hope to think the first is part of the picture, particularly at a spiritual level, as far as learning how to live together and not, so busy about destroying the earth and everything. So I would hope evolving at that level. There's no doubt that there's some biological evolution going on as far or mutation changes that are occurring and adaptations that are occurring. Maybe everybody will soon get a rubber neck so they can look at their iPhones more easily.
Oh, God forbid. That's actually really
been
funny.
Helping there. So I was reading an article from a friend, and he was saying that when his grandchildren come over, like for a Sunday, family outing at his place, that he struggles to talk with them because they're totally immersed into their iPhones, and that they would be on their iPhones at supper time too, except he insists that they check their phones in the other room so they can have a conversation at the dinner table. And he was wondering what kind of impact this is going to have, culturally, socially, and personally, and health-wise too, on everybody. Because I heard of a municipality that passed a law that you can't be looking down at a screen in the road. That's probably a good idea.
I think it's really important. I just saw a thing on the internet, and it was talking about, this fellow was talking about how the iPhone, or the not iPhone, but it's the whole technology thing, that it mm-hmm. really evokes a lot of dopamine in people's brains. And that the kids are kind of like addicted, and that is a true addiction. It's as if it were cocaine, or if it were...
Well, that would really be interesting to see a study on dopamine levels and iPhone usage, or smartphone, whatever. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't heard that.
I just heard it last night, and I went, all right, this is worth thinking about, right?
But yeah, I mean, that should be really measurable, easily proven or disproven, right?
Just yeah, except the part of it is that then the kids should be pleasurable and non-aggressive, I would think. But that's not true. That's not what's happening these days, is it?
I guess it would depend on what you're watching on your phone, maybe, as far as how that might affect. That would be another variable, I think, is what are you looking at on your phone when you're having a dopamine experience, or maybe having an adrenaline experience, or whatever the case might be, a stress experience.
Well, and we probably should get back down to what's really your subject, although this is a part of your subject, isn't it? It's kind of an
It
exciting
is.
part, yeah. Yeah, you
Always
must be
fun to
finding it's
digress.
always different, right?
Indeed. And it's fun to digress and look at different things that are related.
Mm-hmm.
But when it comes to the brain, what's emerging is some really simple basic outline, which is the outline that I used at the co-op class the other night that you attended. Number one is sleep. You know, I mean, sleep has profound effects on the brain, and not just at, oh, yeah, I feel better today, I had a good night's sleep, but when you look at the physiology of it, in the brain, we're always producing waste products. The brain is the biggest consumer of glucose in the body, and it metabolizes a lot of energy, and there are going to be waste products. And the amyloid, the beta amyloid plaque, is one of those waste products. So is it really the cause of Alzheimer's? It looks like it's really not. But what happens with the amyloid plaque is that if it doesn't get cleared out of the brain, it accumulates, becomes problematic. So what clears amyloid plaque out of the brain? Sleep. They used to think that there was no lymphatic circulation in the brain. Now it's been proven definitively just in the last couple of years that there's very strong lymphatic circulation in the brain, and they've called it the glymphatic system, G-L-Y-M, glymphatic instead of lymphatic. Why, I'm not exactly sure, but I guess glio relates to the brain. And it's 8 times more active when you're sleeping than when you're awake.
Oh, wow. So you mean to clean it up.
Exactly. So when you get good sleep, I don't know about drug sleep. That really hasn't been studied. You know, if you're taking Ambien or some kind of sleeping remedy, whether that has much of an effect. We do know that melatonin, of course, is produced abundantly, you know, during sleep, and not just during sleep, but especially during sleep. And melatonin is one of the most powerful antioxidants in the body and has universal access to every cell in the body. So melatonin, there's a great book on it called The Miracle of Melatonin that was done a lot of work in the Japanese medical community and European. And it's quite a remarkable substance. And that's another high significant benefit. When I do hormone testing, I find a lot of people low in melatonin.
Oh, really?
You can really only measure it accurately. You can measure it in different ways, but the most accurate way is in the urine, the 24-hour urine collection.
Mm-hmm.
And but we live in a sleep-deprived culture. I mean, let's face it.
Well, and I mentioned to you when you were giving your class recently that I have never slept well. And you were speaking about melatonin. And I had taken it before to get sleepy and want to go to sleep, but it didn't do anything. So this time I started taking it faithfully. First it was 2 of them 3 times a day, and then I backed it down to 1 3 times a day or twice a day. And took a lot of adrenal support. And guess what? I have been sleeping for the last 3 weeks. And I haven't ever slept very well.
What is your blood type, Veronica?
A.
Yeah. And, you know, the blood typers will tell you that A blood types tend to dominate insomnia. It's not exclusive, of course, but the predominance of insomniacs are A blood types. And, you know, Dr. Mercola has done, on his excellent website, he's done a lot of work on the subject of sleeping and has emphasized it a lot and written many articles on it. I would recommend that your listeners consider going to Mercola.com and checking out what Dr. Mercola has done on sleep. But one of the reports that he wrote maybe a year and a half ago or so was that it doesn't have to be one continuous sleep cycle. So it doesn't have to be 8 hours or 7 hours or whatever, 6 hours of continuous sleep. That it's really the accumulation that matters. And napping is very useful. And even sleep interrupted, before, you know, getting back to sleep. So it's more the
Isn't that a good thing to know, huh?
Yeah, that is a good thing to know. And some sleep expert that he reported on pretty much proved that. So, you know, sometimes we have it, oh, I've got to get 6, 7 hours, 7, 8 hours, whatever, continuous, like when you were teenagers. You know, you could just sleep. But, you know, as adults, that rarely plays out. And yet I find that if I get to bed at a consistent time every night, which I think is very important for me, and I think for most of my clients, too, and for me, that's between 10 and 11, 10 and 10:30, actually, for me personally, that it really helps because I fall asleep quickly and I get into nice, deep sleep rhythms. And if I wake up later on and fall back to sleep, it doesn't really matter that much as long as I continue to accumulate hours of sleep over the course of the day.
Yeah. Oh, that's good to know. I just want to back up for a minute. You mentioned Alzheimer's, and doesn't in Alzheimer's, don't people's brains shrink? And I'm thinking whilst you speak, is it that the brain that the amyloid, what did you call the clearing material? Is it
Lymphatics, the lymph system,
yeah, the plaque that comes up in
and
the
the beta
brain.
amyloid plaque is a
What
byproduct.
does it block? Does it like block the flow of blood and lymph throughout the brain, like waste can do? Or
Well, it
why
doesn't.
does the brain get smaller, as far as you know?
Well, there's some normal shrinkage in brain size with aging in and of itself. Bill Sardi, not Dr. Sardi, but Bill Sardi, who's a medical journalist, he's wrote a great article. I handed it out in class, actually, about the discovery that benfothiamine, it's a strange name. The thiamine, of course, is B1, vitamin B1 thiamine. And benfothiamine, but the way it's spelled, I've been calling it benfoshamine, or some people call it benfotiamine, but it's B as in boy, E, N as in Nancy, F as in Frank, O, T as in Tom, IAMINE, benfothiamine or thiamine. If they just would have kept the H in there, thiamine, it would be benfothiamine, but for whatever reason, the H was dropped, and it's benfotiamine for the spelling here. And benfothiamine or benfoshamine is what I like to call it, has been in the market for quite a while, and it's been used for neuropathy. It's really a good neuropathy remedy. I've even had some success with people that have chemotherapeutic-induced neuropathy.
Wow.
But it's especially effective with diabetic neuropathy, which is pretty common. And now they're finding, and Bill Sardi actually did reported on this researcher who showed increased brain size, actual increase in neuroplasticity, so to speak, increased brain tissue in people that took 6 to 1,200 milligrams of benfothiamine, which is really just a fat-soluble form of vitamin B1.
And
But
that's the
they've actually
courage vitamin, isn't it?
a what?
It's the courage vitamin, isn't it? B1.
Thiamine? Courage, right? I haven't heard that, but perhaps it is. You're referring to like they have a nickname for it?
No, in the old days when we did a lot about B1, B2, B3, B4, B5, each one of them had a specialty. And
Aha.
I remember B1 as I believe it was the courage one. But I have to look that up again.
That's interesting. I've never heard that, but I'd be curious to know
I'll
what
look it up
different.
and we'll phone you back. It's an interesting one. Yeah.
Find a link on it. B1 is traditionally very, very involved in glucose regulation, carbohydrate regulation, and many other functions. But the whole brain connection is emerging now that it's been used for treating neuropathy, and now scientists are working with it, and they're actually showing increased brain size.
So maybe that would have an effect for Alzheimer's, huh?
Well, that's the implication. It's not really been proven, but and they're talking Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, a whole range of different neuromuscular disorders, neurological and neuromuscular disorders. So yeah, I mean it holds a lot of promise. I started taking it myself.
Wow. Have you noticed anything? Because you don't have any like
No, I
huge
can't. I've only
pathologies.
been on it for a couple of weeks, so no, I'm just experimenting with it personally. So sleep clears the beta amyloid plaque and other debris, and then of course that gets in the lymphatic system, and then it works its way into the liver, and the liver converts it into bile, which is a metabolic waste product, and then the bile is, drained through the biliary tree and the gallbladder, which is really a reservoir for the biliary tree, and drains into the gut, and it gets eliminated with the stool. So there's a natural waste removal process there that occurs with the debris, and it's not just beta amyloid plaque; it's other waste products as well that accumulate in the brain just in the course of daily activity that needs to be cleaned out at night. And as I said, the lymphatic system is 8 times more active at night than during the day. That sleep, we've all known this for how long. I mean, sleep is so important, has so many benefits, rejuvenates so many different systems in the body. I mean, sleep is wonderful and essential. I've always joked, you can go months without food, literally. You can go days without water. You can go minutes without oxygen. So obviously, oxygen is our number one nutrient. But next to that, I'd almost put sleep in second place because I could go longer without water than I could without sleep.
Well, that's really interesting. I told you I struggled for many, many, many years without much sleep at all, even as a baby, as a child. But I always use meditation. And it helps me. It seems to, I guess the energy becomes the fuel. You know, I've done pretty well, but I feel much calmer having slept for quite a few weeks now.
Yes, well, that's good to hear. I'm delighted to hear that. And you've done it by kind of dividing your melatonin dose over the course of the day.
And really being fierce about doing it all the time.
Did you say there was another thing as well, or was that it?
Adrenal support.
Adrenal support, yes. You know, the general rule in naturopathic medicine or alternative support would be when you can't fall asleep, the adrenals could be stimulating themselves with wakefulness, stimulating the body with wakefulness. Dr. Royal Lee at Standard Process was one of the theories that he put forth. And so if you're having a hard time falling asleep, it often relates to the adrenals. If you wake up and can't get back to sleep, that's usually a glucose issue where the body goes hypoglycemic, you're sleeping for 3 or 4 hours, and you run out of fuel. Normally or ideally, the body should make a 24-hour reserve of fuel in the form of glycogen, which is stored sugar, which is a job that the liver does, stored glucose. If that isn't occurring efficiently, and a lot of people don't have efficient liver function, even though it may not show up as elevated enzymes in a blood test, which is literally more of a liver disease. But when it comes to function, the liver is such an amazing organ that, you know, it can maintain normal blood chemistry at only 50% function or less. So you can't really go by thinking in terms of it as a liver disease, but if the liver loses efficiency and it doesn't store glycogen efficiently, then you don't have enough to get you through a sleep cycle. Then as the blood sugar goes down, 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 the adrenals kick in with glucocorticoids and they raise the blood sugar and save the day. So they'll bring the blood sugar back up, but glucocorticoids are stress hormones. So now you're up, you wake up, and now you got stress hormones surging through your system, so that's why it's not so easy to fall back to sleep.
Oh, wow. That makes a lot of sense.
So I call those type 2 insomniacs, where it's really a liver glycogen issue, where the body doesn't store enough glucose or glycogen to get you through the night.
Is that just like a personal biochemistry, personal health issue? It's like, what did you inherit? Are you prone to diabetes? Is it all part of that link up?
Yes, especially type 2 diabetes. Your hypoglycemic individuals are hypoglycemia is a precursor to type 2 diabetes, not type 1, but type 2. And, of course, type 2 diabetics have elevated glucose and elevated insulin, and they become insulin resistant, and the cells don't want to accept the insulin that carries the glucose into the cells because at high levels, insulin is a pro-inflammatory, and insulin can even cause cell death if it's high enough. So the cells resist the insulin, and so then the glucose ultimately gets stored as fat. And then we have all sorts of irregularities occurring in fat metabolism. Particularly in triglycerides in a blood test, you'll see that triglyceride elevations tend to parallel pre-diabetes and diabetes type 2. In fact, a lot of people are calling Alzheimer's type 3 diabetes because it's really a glucose, it's the inability of the brain cells to metabolize glucose because of the high insulin. So it's really type diabetes of the brain, but they're calling it type. Some people are calling it type 3 diabetes.
So Alzheimer's is a high insulin situation, is it?
Yes, typically it is.
Wow. And so I knew it was digestion and all that too. Their stomachs don't work that well, do they?
Yes, and you know that's so characteristic though in aging in general, because the production of hydrochloric acid in the stomach is the most energy intensive biological process that occurs in the human body. So nothing takes more biological energy than concentrating nutrients from the blood and concentrating them down to a pH, which is virtually a million times more acidic than the blood. And I mean literally a million. I mean, if the blood is 7.5, actually it should be 7.3, 7.4, but just for the sake of discussion, and the pH is 1.5 in the stomach, healthy stomach should be between 1.5 and 2.0 pH, but the pH scales is logarithmic. So when you go from 7 to the 7.5 to 1.5, that's 10 to the 6, which is a million times more acidic than the blood. So it takes a ton of energy to concentrate nutrients and produce hydrochloric acid in the stomach. And some people are stronger secretors for sure, but many people easily half of the population, as they get older, their stomachs aren't able to produce the kind of hydrochloric acid and other digestive secretions that they could when they were young. I mean, you don't have young people developing, you know, heartburn and reflux and GERD, although it's probably going on now, but it wasn't traditionally, whereas you have so many elderly people as we age who develop those problems. There's where digestive enzymes can be really a wonderful blessing, you know, and you might have to do a little experimenting to find out what type of digestive enzyme suits you the best. But digestive enzymes, including hydrochloric acid or apple cider vinegar, depending upon the individual, can be a godsend. And then pancreatic enzymes or vegetable enzymes, and all these combinations are available in the market. And you have to be willing to do a little trial and error to find out what type of digestive support. But yeah, in general, as we age, digestion gets weak, and it's exaggerated in people that have, you know, Alzheimer's, et cetera. But
well, that's interesting because that has a huge impact on sleep as well. So it's kind of a vicious cycle if you can't digest. Right.
Exactly. And let's say you have the type 2 insomnia where you fall asleep okay, but then you wake up and can't get back to sleep because you ran out of glycogen, and now you have a stress hormone, a glucocorticoid that was secreted to raise the glucose level, but now it wakes you up because it's a stress hormone, and it takes a while for that to wear down so you can fall back to sleep. The way I work with that is you have to work with the liver's ability to store glycogen. And there actually are some nutrients that have been specifically designed for that. One is by Enzymatic Therapy, which is a common health food store brand sold on the internet, called Sweet Defense.
Okay.
They used to call it HypoAid. I wish they would have stayed with the original name. I don't care for the name Sweet Defense, but that's what they call it. And then there's Metagenics, makes a product called Glycogenics. Glycogen, Glycogenics is a multiple designed to help the liver store glycogen. Also, Milk Thistle and liver remedies in general can be very useful in that regard. And then the other thing I'll mention, which can be tricky, is those people should eat a little something before they go to bed. They should pick a food that really agrees with them, that they can digest easily, because I'm typically not a fan of eating before bed. In fact, 3 hours before bed. But in these cases, if they have a little snack before bed, maybe if, you know, a nut butter or something, that whatever. It depends on the person and what they tolerate, and that's the bottom line. Whatever they know they digest well that doesn't bother them, a small amount. Buy a couple of hours of glucose so that you don't run out of glycogen so readily and you'll get a longer sleep cycle.
Hmm.
But ultimately, it's not a cure. It's just trying to manage the situation. And ultimately, you want to, restore the liver's function to store glycogen.
Well, now this sounds crazy, but what's worked for me at times is I get up and I go in and I get some raw broccoli and I eat it in the middle of the night.
Well, that's interesting, and that helps.
Helps a lot, yes. It calms me down, even if it doesn't throw me to sleep. Sometimes it'll put me to sleep.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting choice.
And I've been teased about it for probably 50 years. But
raw broccoli.
Yeah.
Now, that wouldn't do a lot of people, although it would to me, but I know a lot of people, that a lot of your listeners would go, "Oh, broccoli in the middle of the night."
But, you know, when people say that sort of thing to me, I say, well, guess what? If it works, I don't care if I like it or not.
Right.
You know.
So, you know, after sleep, which is now becoming a major thing relative to understanding the whole Alzheimer's situation and cleaning the brain of the metabolic byproducts, the waste products that need to be cleaned at sleep through the lymphatic system. And then the next step would be exercise. A lot has been emphasized, you know, both exercise that exercises the brain exercises like reading and studying things and doing things to keep your brain sharp and active. You know, that's all good stuff. But also physical exercise, and it doesn't have to be extreme. It doesn't have to be, you know, a super aggressive, you know, workout that's going to, you know, put you through the ringer, so to speak, and you'll be sweating bullets and everything. But getting out, getting exercise, getting oxygen, you know, picking up your heart rate, it doesn't have to be extreme, but regular exercise definitely helps. And here again, we're dealing with our number one nutrient, which is obviously oxygen. So we have become a pretty sedentary culture, you know, this historically, even when I was a kid in the 50s and the 60s, I mean, we played all day long. I mean, we didn't have any technology. We had a TV, but, you know, in those days you turned your TV on and that dot appeared and about 5 minutes later the screen was lit up, you know.
And we had test patterns and a whole bunch of stuff, yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was only at nighttime, and we were forbidden to watch TV during the day and whatever. So we were all playing. I mean, we, you know, and I'm thankful for it. But it's just not kids, but there was just so much exercise involved in living, even though it may have not been planned exercise, it was just built into the lifestyle that just isn't there anymore. So you have to consciously choose to get exercise, choose to get outside, get some fresh air, take a walk, you know, get your heart rate up. It doesn't have to be extreme, but there's no question that exercise is very good for the brain, mm-hmm. and that includes specific brain exercises. And, you know, there's websites you can go to that'll measure your cognitive ability and then put you through exercises to improve that and then retest you and that kind of thing. I don't know that that's necessary, but that might appeal to some people. And but there's no getting around that exercise is a major player as far as not just overall health, but specific brain health as well.
Hmm. Have you heard those studies where they say if you've got three groups of people, this one is practicing basketball like mad, this one is practicing in its mind only like mad, and this one is not practicing at all, and group one and group two have the same amount of talent when they're finally physically tested. And that's
sure.
because their brain, what is it? Their brain created the connections it takes to make those wonderful basketball moves, right? Have you read
Yeah,
all
the
that
muscle
stuff?
Memory. I think it was actually free throws specifically that you know, shooting the basketball that was studied. Years ago in my early 20s, I actually taught Silva Mind Control.
Ah.
And that exact study that you're referring to was known then, you know, and... yeah, it was a fun cycle in my early 20s to develop a public speaking experience, and it was a great discipline. You know, the visualization and the meditation and the relaxation exercises were wonderful.
So if we're lolling around on the couch all day and imagining our deep knee bends and our, would that work? Or is that just, I'm being silly now, but I wouldn't do it that way. I like to move, but.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting point, but you can certainly train muscle memory by visualizing it in your brain. But as far as oxygenating the body, I think you better put on your shoes and take a walk. Whatever,
yeah.
How you like to do.
I love that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. We were just out cross-country skiing yesterday. That was great. I really do enjoy cross-country skiing. It's exhilarating. It's a great workout, you know, a couple hours in the snow. It's fun.
Great.
Of course, you're in Southern California right now, so I assume you are.
Nope, I'm in Everett, Washington.
You're in Everett. Mm-hmm. I see. Yeah, mm-hmm. So we drove into Canada yesterday to get some really good snow to go cross-country skiing.
Oh, that's wonderful. So let's talk about, and that is very refreshing, isn't it, to go out like that. But let's talk about memory and aging, or I don't know if these are actually related, but the ADD and autism stuff that's all happening at this time. Can you talk a bit about that? And is it plastic? Can we make some changes in the brain?
Well, sure. And you can see some nutritional chemistries that are associated with people that have ADD and ADHD and kids and whatever you want to call it. In hair analysis, for example, you'll see high copper, low zinc, and low calcium and high phosphorus. And they'll be pretty revved up. Their autonomic nervous systems are on the gas pedal. They're real sympathetic dominant individuals with zinc deficiencies. But I think that a big part of it is training. We're talking about visualizing things and actually training your brain and shooting free throws and doing just as well as people who practice free throws, et cetera. You know, and one advantage to doing it in your brain is you can make them all the time. or else you could discipline yourself to think of it as making it all the time. But look at TV. It's just boom, 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 boom. I mean, no wonder kids are hyper. I mean, the TV is hyper, and the constant. I mean, stimulation, stimulation, stimulation. I mean, our culture has become a culture of stimulation, and so I think when you overstimulate the nervous system when kids are young, you know, the electronic world, the digital world. You know, you have little infants, you know, in their iPhones, and it's like you're constantly being expected to be entertained. And things are occurring so quick and so visual, and you know, and the sound variance on TV, you know, gets louder when they put a commercial on, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I think our whole culture is overstimulated.
Mm-hmm.
And look at the caffeine consumption of the culture. You know, caffeine is definitely the drug of choice of our culture. And I know that coffee's getting all sorts of good reviews these days, but there's so much to look at when it comes to caffeine. And one of the interesting studies, insects is they spiders that were spinning webs is they would take one, you know, they take the spider and they would watch how kind of web it spun, and then they would feed it caffeine, and then they would evaluate the web that it spins. I mean, it's really distorted. Then they would give it like cannabis, and you'd see another type of distortion in the web, and then they'd give it like speed or cocaine or whatever, and you can actually see how this spider, you know, is spinning all these strange and irregular shaped webs under these different meds. And when you look at the one that was done under caffeine, it looks like a speedy, like almost like an amphetamine type of a cobweb.
Wow, that's incredible.
Yeah, that's all over. You can find that on the internet, spiders and drugs, if you just look it up. And that was just one kind of clever way. It doesn't prove anything other than how it affects spiders, right? But we just, and look at the caffeine consumption in children. I mean, I almost had no caffeine as a child, thank goodness, except for the limited amount of soda pop that we were allowed to drink, which, and there was like 6 or 7 ounce bottles in those days, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of the ADD and ADHD type things that we're dealing with culturally are trained, and then we physiologically support that habit of overstimulation from all the electronics with caffeine, which just jacks it up to another level, and then sugar. And then a lack of nutrients and nutrition. You know, we don't get nearly the minerals and trace minerals and vitamins and minerals and even the diverse protein characteristics of a diverse diet. We don't have the essential fats in our diet the way we used to. You know, grain-fed animals don't produce omega-3s in their milk or their meat or their fat, whereas if they're grass-fed, they do. I mean, so everything has changed so much. I think it's just a natural, I don't know if natural, but I think it's an expected, almost what we could anticipate that this would happen to the culture when everybody's overstimulated, and then we back that up with caffeine and other types of stimulants, and then on top of that, you know, other drugs, whatever. So, you know, I don't know specifically I don't think there's any brain. There's nothing to diagnose ADD or ADHD in any kind of clinical setting. Hair analysis is the closest, but there's no blood test for it. You know, it's a psychological evaluation that doctors do with kids and adults to determine whether or not they have ADD or ADHD. But I think it's really just a natural offshoot of what we've done culturally.
But they can be born that way because of the parents having that overstimulation, right?
Sure. I mean, who knows? I mean, nothing's been studied in the womb. But, you know, the Secret Life of the Unborn Child by Verney, V-E-R-N-E-Y, great book for anybody who's expecting or wants to have children or pregnant, whatever. The Secret Life of the Unborn Child, turns out that the child in the womb is readily connected, not just to the mother's unconscious, but to the whole culture, and is a lot more aware of what's going on than we think. And you can even sing songs to the baby that the child will recognize immediately when it comes out of the womb, you know, very, very young, you know, just a couple days old or even hours old, and then sing that song to that child, and the child just identifies with it. I mean, you can communicate with children in the womb. The Secret Life of the Unborn Child is a dynamite classic book from yesteryear, which is just as pertinent now as it ever was. So who knows? The mother's drinking caffeine, the mother's drinking coffee, or, you know, the mother is overstimulated with her job or work or whatever. I mean, who knows? There's so many stress factors in our lifestyle that could come into the picture.
Well, we have a sort of a whole bunch of chemicals that are kind of coming through our dietary sources, plus the broken foods, you know, the broken grains or whatever, as well.
Exactly. And the Feingold diet from yesteryear back in the that was all about food chemicals and coloring agents and things overstimulating children, or maybe the mother eats them. And it affects the baby in the womb. Who knows? These things have never really been studied. The Feingold diet was a pretty successful diet back then. It certainly wasn't 100%, but some people definitely benefited from it. Mm-hmm. And like my wife, who used to teach nutrition at the University of Wisconsin, Karen, you know, has a master's in nutritional science, and she was a registered dietitian back in the 70s. And she jokes that what she learned about nutrition in those days at the university level is that it wasn't very important. If you wanted to learn nutrition, you had to go to veterinarian school because they learned good nutrition, because they knew with animals they better keep them, better keep their nutrients functional, otherwise they're going to have a sick animal. Well, I guess that might apply to human beings too, you know, come on. But she used to say that, and this kind of got her in trouble with her boss, that all these food chemicals, they've been studied individually, but they've never been studied collectively, and you never eat them one at a time. You could eat have a meal, a fast food restaurant, and consume 20 different food chemicals.
I know.
They've never been. in combination with each other. So nobody knows, but I think it's really perfectly logical that we're living in a culture that's overstimulated mm-hmm. and is dealing with ADD and ADHD and all the things that we have, including Alzheimer's.
Well, so let's take a look at ADD. Sorry to interrupt you, but can we help change those brains of those kids, for example?
Sure. I mean, you can certainly, you know, if they're willing, you know, it depends on age, it depends on parental guidance and, you know, discipline, et cetera. First of all, you can limit the stimulation. You know, mm-hmm. like my friend who wrote this article who said, when you come to the supper table, you got to put your cell phone in the other room. I realize that's nothing in comparison to the hours that people put on their cell phones. But realistically, it's a step in the direction of limiting the stimulation that way.
Or also respecting one-on-one interactions as well. Respecting human interaction.
Learning how to communicate. Mm-hmm. You know that one ad on TV where the grandson is upstairs and the grandmother's downstairs, and he texts or he calls his grandma or he emails her and says, "Would you bring me another grape soda?"
And she says, "I hope she says no."
And well, no, she does it, but she gives you the look like, "Oh, what's this kid or something wrong here?" But hydration, let's get that in the outline of brain health. Hydration, you know, I was just looking at a hormone profile this morning, and the person's creatinine was really high. This is a urine test that's tested four times over the course of the day, and she's waking up dehydrated. And so, I mean, dehydration is really pretty common in our culture. Dr. Batman, as they call him, who wrote the book Your Body's Many Cries for Water, he was an Iranian physician who was put in prison for political reasons. He was a political prisoner, and he was treating men in the prison with water because that's the only remedy he had to work with. And he discovered, wow, water's pretty powerful stuff. You know, you can really do a lot with it therapeutically. And so we live in a culture that drinks more soda pop than water. Literally, I'm not exaggerating, that we exceeded our soda pop consumption exceeded water consumption, I think, about 5 or 6 years ago or something to that effect. And you really don't hydrate when caffeine is a dehydrator. Sugar is a dehydrating substance. You know, diuretics, I'm trying to think of some of the other obvious dehydrating substances. But there are many in our culture, and we don't really drink half our body weight in ounces of water. So if you weigh 200 pounds, you drink 100 ounces of water.
Every day.
And the brain is a healthy brain is 83 to 85% water. Hmm. It's, you know, the whole body is mostly water when it's healthy. A baby can be born up to 90, 85, 90% water. Most adults die at around 50% water. So there's a gradual dehydration process that occurs as we age, and maybe that a certain element of that is natural and unavoidable. But in general, people don't drink water and hydrate adequately. So that's another thing that goes into the brain formula, that you really want to hydrate the body, because not only is it essential for brain health, it's essential for every cell in the body. Mm-hmm. And by and large, we have a somewhat sleep-deprived culture, a culture that doesn't get enough exercise, and a culture that doesn't drink enough water.
Hmm. So we're unhydrated.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. So that kind of ages the old wrinkle part of aging kind of improves.
Absolutely. It wrinkles the whole aging, mm-hmm. the whole aging process is associated with dehydration. Absolutely.
It is, isn't it? I can see that. Wow.
So, I'm not saying you're stop aging or reverse aging just by drinking more water, but you can certainly make the process more healthy and more functional and clear, and, you know, without some of the consequences of aging and the symptoms. So we haven't even talked about diet yet, but we probably should.
Let's get at it. It's a very interesting subject, because I realize as you speak, it's so intricately complicated, isn't it? You know, it's not just one thing.
It is, and yet you try to simplify it so people can understand and be motivated to take action.
Mm-hmm.
So sleep, exercise, hydration, diet. Well, when it comes to diet, we're back to the type 3 diabetes or the type 2 diabetes. And if you look at Mary Newport's YouTube videos, she's a physician. Her husband had Alzheimer's disease. He was flunking his cognitive tests. And she figured, you know, his brain is not metabolizing glucose. So I'll switch him to ketones. Now, ketones is just a fat. When you burn fat for energy, you're in ketosis, or you're burning ketones. You can measure them in your urine. There's no risk. There's no real concern. It's not like an animal that goes into ketosis. And we're not talking about ketosis, diabetic, or any of that type of situation. We're just talking about ketosis in a fairly healthy person is not an issue. The brain is, and the body, every cell in the body is fully capable of burning fat. Those are the two sources of fuel, fat and glucose. And if the body breaks down protein into fuel, it breaks it into glucose. So protein can be broken into glucose as well. That's why carbs and proteins have 4 calories per gram. They have the same amount of calories, because if protein is used for fuel, it's broken down into glucose. So when a person fasts, for example, and fasting, by the way, is proving to be a dynamic health profile, a health supplement, if you will, for brain health and for the health of the whole body. Dr. Longo at University of Southern California is like the leader in this field, and his research is astonishing. They have found that fasting is the only thing that regenerates stem cells and mitochondria. So they don't really have anything for regenerating stem cells. That's why they're thinking in terms of stem cell transplants. But fasting regenerates the stem cells you already have. And mitochondria, which are the little entities in cells that burn, that produce energy, or what's called ATP in the body, the mitochondria, as they get older, they get gummed up with waste products, and they just don't function as efficiently, and so energy production is decreased. But fasting clears up the mitochondria and regenerates normal mitochondria function. It's the only thing known to do that. And that's why intermittent fasting has become so popular. So when you look at diet, you almost have to look at the undiet, the fasting. You know, Karen and I like to fast Mondays, like today, and Thursdays. Hmm. So I'll fast tomorrow morning. And then on Thursday, so we'll fast 2 days a week. And that's kind of what Mosley recommends in his book, The Fast Diet. He's a doctor journalist from England who did a great BBC production on this whole theme. Very entertaining, very well done. And, you know, we've known that calorie restriction is tremendously healthy. And so this whole fasting thing kind of spins off of that research. I first, when I was a freshman at the University of Wisconsin, I was working in a cancer research lab. It was such a depressing place. It's just a part-time job for me. All I did was walk in and inject rats with chemotherapy.
Oh, no.
There were thousands of rats and rooms and whole floors full of cages.
Oh.
And I asked them, and they only fed them every other day. I thought that was kind of mean. And here I am sticking them with needles and injecting them with chemo, and I'm worried about whether they got ate that day. And it turns out, so my supervisor says, well, they live twice as long. And I went, what? They live twice as long if you feed them every other day? Well, it turns out, and this is well known in laboratory circles, turns out that they live 50% longer. That's not twice as long. But they do live significantly longer if you fast them a day and feed them a day.
That's remarkable, hey?
It's well known in laboratory circles, Veronica, no doubt. It's interesting. And so now they're applying it to human beings. We're seeing, oh, my gosh. And when you look at all the great, well, even the great spiritual teachers, you know, if you're Christian, you look at Jesus. And, you know, if you're a Buddhist, you look at Buddha. And if Muhammad, if you're Islamic, you know, they all fasted. All the spiritual teachers fasted. And not just a little bit. You know, if Jesus, for example, if the biblical story is accurate, 40 days, that's certainly possible. Dr. Fung, F-U-N-G, a medical doctor in California, runs a fasting clinic. Dr. Mercola has been all over this big time, too. And for me, it was personal, because when I was in my early 20s, it was fasting that cured me of my chronic boils and my terrible seasonal allergies that sometimes resulted in wheezing fits. So I had a mentor who put me on fast and had me repeat the fast every change of the season, and that completely resolved all those problems.
Well, I guess those toxic residues each create a kind of an allergic response, too, when they pile up in the body, don't they?
Sure. You're much more likely to develop problems when the body is toxic like that, no question. And, you know, the whole body, our whole lifestyle is fairly toxic. Yeah, so intermittent fasting is tremendously therapeutic for the brain, for the entire body, for the mitochondria, for the stem cells, and it goes on and on. Some of the specific foods that you really want to be careful for brain health is you don't want too many omega-6 fatty acids, which our diet has become dominant in.
Okay.
You want to balance that with omega-3s, which have wonderful clinical benefits. And you want to avoid trans fats or margarine or hydrogenated, same thing. Trans, hydrogenated, margarine, all the same thing. They're left-handed fats that the body can't metabolize. And so getting rid of junk fats, getting rid of fried foods will also create trans fats and oxidized fats. When you heat an oil in the presence of oxygen, which is like everywhere, you form peroxides or rancid fats. and they're known carcinogens and very detrimental to body chemistry. And we don't even know the effect on the brain, but we do know that the brain is very sensitive to high quality fat.
Hmm.
Yeah. So, and then we get to the carbs. I mean, if you're pushing pre-diabetes, if you're already a type 2 diabetic and your glucose metabolism, you know, if you have high insulin levels, you have to cut the carbs in order to get insulin under control. I realize type 2 diabetes is a more scientific, you know, more specific, I should say, sophisticated is the word, than just cutting carbs and getting insulin under control. But that has to be the foundation of the whole process. You have to cut back carbs. And, you know, 10 years ago, the average American was consuming like 150 pounds of sugar per year, 45 gallons of soda pop per year. I mean, when you eat like Americans are eating, you just set the stage for what we're dealing with. It's cause and effect. It's very logical. Mr. Irons, back in the 70s, in the early 70s, he predicted that if Americans continued, he was the man, my mentor, who put me on fasting programs, and he was quite an outspoken man, and he predicted back then that if Americans continued to eat, that diabetes would become an epidemic.
Wow, and it really is. Hmm.
I know, and I remember sometime in the 90s or thereabouts, I said to Karen, my wife, I said, you know, Mr. Irons, you know, I guess he didn't quite have that prediction right, because we thought, well, that was in the 70s, here we are in the 90s, and we're not in a diabetic epidemic. Well, we are now. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt about that, and an obesity epidemic, because they go hand in hand. And
wow,
that just feeds into the whole heart disease situation.
And I remember, and I think we talked about this before, Adele Davis, who wrote Let's Eat Right to Keep Fit, in the 50s said, if they keep doing to the wheat what they've done, by the turn of the century, you're going to have more gay people or fertility problems than you ever imagine. Ta-da!
Oh, really? Yeah. I didn't realize Adele Davis predicted that back then.
She did,
and
it was in the early 50s, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that remarkable? But it does tell us that a lot of the power of reversing some of these things is in our own knowledge, in our hands, isn't it?
It's totally in our hands, and it's totally a choice. I mean, it may not be a choice for the kid who's just raised that way, but for adults who can start to think for themselves, and even though you've been perhaps nutritionally abused, that's an interesting phrase. I don't think I've ever said that before.
I like it. It's a good line.
Yeah, nutritionally abused kids sitting in front of the TV on Saturday mornings watching cartoons and just being sold all the junk you can possibly imagine. I mean, the worst things that they could eat, and not just sold, but cleverly sold, you know, very sophisticated, very, you know, well, very ADD, you know, boom, 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 you know, the thing, the color, the change, it's just constantly fluctuating all the time, unlike TVs from our childhood.
Mm-hmm.
So,
and
yeah,
here's the thing, is that we had soda pop and so on when we were young. I hardly ever had any. We weren't allowed to. But now the young kids, some of the young ones that are verging on the hormonal shift and in around that, they're living on Red Bull.
You
know? I'm going, oh, my gosh. So you got computer games, you've got violence like mad, and you drink Red Bull and you're 12. I'm like, oh, this is really great for the – look at the brain. What happens then?
Right. Well, exactly. It'll be interesting to see how it all plays out. But I think as we become adults and we can start thinking for ourselves, we realize this is a choice. It may not be an easy choice because we've been raised a certain way. And we have to break a lot of bad habits, but it's still a choice. You know, that if to basically take control of your health. That's the theme. And your health is your best wealth.
Tell me this about it. It really is. What about fasting? Those of us who have a lot of hypoglycemia and stuff, I'm afraid of fasting, you know. But you mentioned, when I mentioned that to you before, you mentioned a calorie count that would help be able to fast with a balancing force. Is that right? Like 600,
mm-hmm.
600, what did you say? 600.
But Mosley uses. Yeah, what Dr. Mosley uses is 500 calories for women, 600 calories for men. So if you stay underneath that calorie count, then he still considers it intermittent fasting. His ideal situation is to have 500 or 600 calories of vegetables. You can fill your stomach for a lot of veggies for 500 or 600 calories.
Mm-hmm.
That's the way to do it, because then you get the benefits of the vegetables, all of which are wonderful benefits, and you can eat and stabilize. And like Dr. Fung, and he's all over YouTube, FUNG, definitely recommend that your listeners consider checking out his YouTubes. Mercola's interviewed him. Many people have interviewed him. And I show his 30-minute video in the fasting class that I teach at the co-op. And he has a great attitude about it. And he's taking seriously ill people and having tremendous clinical benefits through fasting. I guess he says in that video that the longest fast was over 300 days. Probably a person like weighed 400 pounds. But that's how long you can go without food if you have a lot of fat to burn.
What about addictions? Can you use fasting for that, for clearing that part of the brain that is just running that demand?
Fasting has universal benefits throughout the body, and so I don't know that any study's been done. It probably has, as far as using fasting as a way of breaking addictions and clearing addictions and resolving addictions, because that's ultimately where you want to be, where it's no longer an addiction. But I think that's a feasible, it's plausible, but I'm not aware of it per se, but it wouldn't surprise me that, that it would be an effective way to deal with something like that. Some people go to jail, and they break their addiction. They're not exactly fasting, but they're fasting from the drug. I was talking to somebody who has a son in jail, and he was glad because his son was on the verge of killing himself on methamphetamine.
Wow.
And making money by robbing meth dealers. Now, that's really dangerous. And so now he's in jail, and the whole family's relaxed, and it's like, oh gosh, at least we've got 5 or 6 years here where we know that it's okay.
That's a real tricky one, isn't it?
Very tricky. Mm-hmm. So fasting and breaking addictions would be an interesting approach. I know that it certainly broke addictions for me, but I repeated the fast with 7-day fast 4 times a year at the change of the seasons, and Karen and I still do that. We still do a 7-day cleansing program. It doesn't always have to be a fast, but it'll always involve some degree of fasting. And Dr. Longo says that if you're willing to fast 4 days on water 3 times a year, that the benefits are so profound metabolically that it doesn't matter what you eat. And now that's hard for me to say, being a clinical nutritionist. And I might even, not say that because I don't agree with that personally, that it doesn't matter what you eat. But that's what they're seeing in laboratory experiments, that the benefits are that profound. Now, if you combine that with a good diet in between the fasting, that I think would be altogether more beneficial. But that's how powerful fasting has become. And, there are some supplements I should mention, too, that are used. And we talked about benfotiamine or benfothiamine or benfotiamine, however you want to pronounce it, for brain development. But it's also being studied specifically for Alzheimer's. Ginkgo is another remedy that's been used for, another remedy that's been used for memory, and choline, because choline is a major player in neurotransmitters in the body. Serine is another nutrient, both L-serine and phosphatidylserine.
Oh, wait a minute. So choline would be good for memory then, would it?
Exactly. Okay. Yeah, so good for memory, ginkgo, choline, serine, phosphatidylserine. I didn't mention Mary Newport. I mentioned her earlier and we kind of digressed. She's the gal who then, with her husband, she's a physician, he has Alzheimer's, she decided to feed him ketones and more or less put him in ketosis. And she used coconut oil because it has a lot of medium chain fats, which burn quickly. And he started to improve immediately. And in 3 months, he was passing cognitive tests.
Whoa. And it's coconut oil, little old coconut oil.
Oils, yes. Puts the brain cells, because when your brain can't metabolize sugar, it is still capable of metabolizing ketones. And so she just shifted his fuel from glucose to ketones. And I even saw a video on YouTube with an Australian couple where if he takes a tablespoon of coconut oil every 3 hours, he's functional all day. If he goes 4 hours, he starts losing his memory, and if he goes too long, he loses the benefit. So it's not a cure. It's a way of helping the body, helping the person cope with what's going on in the brain. But it hasn't proven to be a cure. Of course, the medical community is all over this, and they're trying to develop certain, medium-chain triglycerides, which are high in coconut oil, that would be drug-like, take the patient to a whole other level. And they'll probably come up with something. But it was originally developed around ketosis. So anybody in my practice who has a neuromuscular problem, a neurological problem. I want to put them in ketosis to see how they respond. So if a person has Parkinson's or Alzheimer's or whatever, MS, et cetera, I want to put them in ketones and put them in ketosis, get them to burn fat, burning ketones, check the urine to see how deep they are into ketosis. I want them in fairly deep ketosis, not light ketosis.
Well, what is ketosis? Can you tell me the parameters of it? Does it mean like a trance or a...
No, ketosis is just burning fat for energy, for fuel.
Okay.
Yeah, burning fat for fuel puts you in ketosis.
Okay.
Measure the ketones in your urine. Hmm. And that's what the Atkins diet was. Hmm. Now, the Atkins diet wasn't all that healthy because it was just so much dairy and so much meat and some vegetables. But basically, when you really look at what guys on the Atkins, mostly what guys on the Atkins diet, they just ate meat and dairy, meat and cheese, and they were in ketosis. And they lost a ton of weight, their cholesterol's plummeted, their lipids improved. I mean, their whole body chemistry improved when they were in ketosis. It's dramatic.
Hmm.
That's what Atkins was the first one who really popularized lowering your insulin, because insulin resistance is what creates the whole type 2 diabetic profile. And with the type 2 diabetic profile, 98% of diabetics have put a lot of weight on.
Mm-hmm. That's true, isn't it? So, unfortunately, we're going to run out of time shortly. So, I wonder if you could do us a big favor and give us a list of brain support supplements or dietary things. You've given us fasting and benfotiamine. You've given us coconut oil, and I'm going, what about metal detox? And there's something in my notes about Fiji water. Can you talk about that a little bit? Maybe give us a little list of what we could use in our life.
Toxic metals are an issue. And so Fiji water is one of the only substances, if you drink a liter a day for 6 months, you can remove the aluminum. And aluminum is indicted in the whole brain deal. I mean, aluminum has been known to be a factor and neuromuscular diseases for a long time, but it's never gotten any real research. It hasn't been funded, et cetera. So in that sense...
But it's connected to Alzheimer's, isn't it?
Clearly connected to Alzheimer's.
Mm-hmm.
But aluminum has been especially hard to clear, but the Fiji water's revolutionized it. It's high in silicates, and other waters are too, but Fiji's especially high.
Hmm.
And I just put a person with high aluminum in on Fiji water, in 6 months, her aluminum went down to virtually zero.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that's pretty exciting, isn't it? Yes.
Yeah, she was totally, yes, and she was totally intent to get rid of that aluminum, and she drank a liter of Fiji water a day. Okay, well, some of the supplements, vitamin D is very substantial and very specific to, if vitamin D is one of the few nutrients that has almost universal access to every cell in the body. It's very important. It's very, very healthy for the brain. And you want to get up to at least 65, minimum of 65 in the blood range. Blood range is 30 to 100. 65 is the exact mid-range. Niacinamide, which is a form of vitamin B3, is also specific to brain function, brain health, and has actually a track record, especially in laboratory animals, treating Alzheimer's and even reversing Alzheimer's. Dr. David Williams, in his publication, Alternatives, he specifically reported on this a couple years ago, and it's become popular in that regard. You have to take, 1 to 3,000 milligrams a day. But niacinamide is also a wonderful anti-inflammatory, nutritional anti-inflammatory. Ginkgo, I think I might have mentioned that earlier. Ginkgo is excellent. Choline is excellent. Phosphatidylcholine is excellent. Fish oil, your essential omega-3 fatty acids are very important. So you have a whole range of nutrients that can be used, but none of these nutrients is really going to overcome some of the things we talked about earlier, which are so important. So this should be, like diet and sleep and hydration. You want to combine the nutrients with that approach so that you have a comprehensive approach.
Sounds like those three, diet, sleep, and hydration, are the key, what supports for our evolution, right?
Yeah, your foundation, mm-hmm. your foundation. Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
That's really exciting, and I wish we had longer time. I've so appreciated Your knowledge is just incredible, and I love that every time I speak with you, whatever the subject is, you've already pushed the envelope. You've gone farther on all that research. How exciting! What an exciting job you have.
I do like it. It's really a lot of fun to work in this field. You meet a lot of interesting people, and it surely keeps you busy. So, and all my mentors, they never retired. You know, Mr. Irons never retired. Paul Bragg never retired. You know,
And why
they
would
just.
you? It's like being an artist, an explorer, right?
Yeah, I mean, if you like what you're doing, you'd want to. I mean, and I do. So it's you want to continue to do it and meet a lot of interesting people like yourself and many clients and others. And yeah, so
Give
I
people
mean,
your
I've been.
contact number so they can be in touch with you.
Sure, it's 360-734-9777. 360-734-9777.
And tell your not email, your website, which talks about the product, the water purifying product you have.
Well, we have yes, and we have a whole range of different information beyond the water information on the website. It's goodtothelastdrop.com. Just all small case and all letters, no numbers. Goodtothelastdrop.com, and my email is jim@goodtothelastdrop.com. Yeah, I was shocked that Maxwell Hall didn't secure that domain, but they didn't.
Good.
And yeah, it's easy to remember. Yeah.
Yo, that was
Yeah.
wonderful. Well, Jim Emke, thank you so much for being a steadily, what, active paradigm shifter.
You're so welcome, Veronica. It's always a pleasure.
It's always a pleasure for me, too. And this is Veronica Entwistle saying thank you so much for listening to Paradigm Shifters. And Jim's interview is going to be up on podcasts probably by next week. So thanks very much. Be in touch, veronicaentwistle.com.